On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton leads all Democratic rivals in early presidential polls, some say by as much as 13 points. But it's been a long, rough road to that remarkable spot. As a child with a too strict father, a wife with a wandering husband president, a woman with big dreams and big pushback, time has changed Hillary Clinton, and you can hear it. Here she is in 1983 before the Arkansas Educational Standards Committee.
The road to being somebody in this society starts with education. And we intend to be sure that everybody in this room and every child in this state is somebody.
And here she is in February 2007.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I'm running for president. I'm in, and I'm in to win, because we have to take our country back.
This hour, On Point, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Carl Bernstein and his big new biography of Hillary Rodham Clinton, A Woman in Charge. Joining me from San Francisco is legendary reporter Carl Bernstein. With Bob Woodward, he did the Watergate reporting for the Washington Post that brought down President Richard Nixon. He's co-author with Woodward of All the President's Men in the Final Days. Dustin Hoffman played Bernstein in the 1976 movie All the President's Men. Carl Bernstein, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Cash for rehash is the Clinton campaign camp word on the new bios coming out. What do you say to that, Carl Bernstein?
Typical. It's the same phrase, actually. It's a rehashed phrase. It's the same phrase that pretty much that they used for Jennifer Flowers and they used in the old days. It was cash for trash in those days. What is remarkable and disheartening about it is that it was issued before they had a book, before they read a book, when there were only some news reports about the book. And it's indicative of the fact that they don't want this book out there. Why don't they want the book out there? Because it's really it's a new story.
640 pages. You go all the way back to the beginning. What is it?
We have had up until now all the canned, self-promoted biography given by Hillary Clinton and by her acolytes and in her so-called autobiography. Finally, by doing the kind of reporting that I do, I was able to go back, starting with her childhood, to those who knew her the best, who spoke on the record for the most part, and present a whole picture of her life that puts pretty much everything in a new light, I think. Certainly, that's what the reviewers seem to have said. I was just thinking about the Wall Street Journal talking about, damned if there isn't a lot that we didn't know about Hillary Clinton.
Now, let me ask you on that front. You know, when she came out for this presidential campaign, this was one of her own lines, words to the effect of, I may be the most famous person that you don't really know. So are you and she singing from the same hymn book there?
We start from the same premise. I think my premise is a little more straightforward. I want you to know. She doesn't want you to know. And it's really a shame because she's infinitely more interesting. Her saga is more fascinating. She's better when she shows her rough edges than the airbrushed picture that she's determined and her campaign is determined to show because— As happened in the White House, this notion of attacking the messenger, which is to say me, and I've had some experience with that, has backfired on her. And, you know, take Whitewater. Whitewater was never, as I say in the book, Whitewater was never about anything of huge importance, but she made it to be partly by hiding what was there. You know, I would have hoped that she would have welcomed this book and said, you know, I don't agree with some of the interpretations in it, but he's really gone. He's talked to Betsy Ebeling, my closest childhood friend. He's talked to Donna Shalala, my friend and Secretary of Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. And yes, Donna Shalala says it's true that she and Lloyd Benson were opposed to my being head of health care. They thought it would be a disaster.
In the big health care reform push in 93.
Yes, they were right. But instead out of that, you know, this is what we have found from the Clinton apparatus in the White House, and now we see the same thing coming from the Clinton campaign, an unwillingness to deal candidly with accurate information, and it's very dismaying, well, especially for a candidate for the president of the United States, and particularly a candidate who stands for as many good things as she does.
But, okay, okay.
But this is a huge problem for her.
We hear it. I mean, we're in the full heat of political combat now, and people will weigh her words and will weigh your words and interpretation closely. Happy for us. We've got some time to do that. I'd love to just begin to dig in here. We've got some big questions, but we want to get some of what you found that's new on the table. Roll the tape back for us, Carl Bernstein. You went all the way back to childhood, so tell us something we don't know about Hillary Clinton's early years.
We've known a little piece that she's once described her dad as kind of a rough customer, but in fact he was a sour, unfulfilled man. Who was a martinet, who abused verbally and humiliated her mother. Most people who came to the house and for the first time wondered why Hillary's mother had stayed with her father rather than walked out of the marriage. It was that noticeable and an undercurrent of tension and humiliation. And he would constantly say at dinner, don't let the doorknob hit you in the ass on the way out the door when she would threaten to leave.
To Hillary's mother.
Mother.
And your source for that is how do you know something like that?
I spent many hours with Betsy Ebeling, who was Hillary's closest friend from childhood, who spent more hours in that house than any of Hillary's friends.
Was he abusive directly?
And also with family members.
Was he abusive directly to his daughter Hillary?
Abusive. He beat his children.
What do you mean by that exactly?
That.
Is that a spanking?
I do not know the extent of it. She says that he was not one to spare the rod, and that sometimes it was excessive, more often in the case of her brother, she says, than herself. But I think it's about an aura. It's about an atmosphere. He had been a drill instructor in World War II, and he brought that attitude to his own house, demeaning, impossible to satisfy. But the one thing that he also did is he believed that there was no reason his daughter couldn't do anything that her brothers couldn't do.
How did you see, or how did her friends that you spoke with see that parenting affecting Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Well, obviously, if you have an impossible to please father, he wouldn't spend on the things that Hillary thought girls should have, including clothes. He was parsimonious in the extreme. It was an ugly atmosphere. And I'm not a a psychologist, so I'll leave it for. But again, this question of divorce and Hillary's mother saying, to Hillary and to her brothers at times when they faced crises in their marriage, you do not get divorced in this family. We do not get divorced. Try counseling. Try other things first. One of the people I spoke to was Nicole Boxer Rodham, who was married to Hillary's brother and was in the White House during the Lewinsky period. Lived there part of the time and was getting divorced from her brother. And she told me about Dorothy's attitude toward divorce and how strong it was. And Hillary, of course, has written about how children are like little boats that can be submerged in divorce. So you start to see the connections.
Roll forward to college years, then, both her own and when in law school she meets this Bill Clinton of Arkansas. What's the profile of the young woman who people saw at that time?
First of all, she was known in the Northeast college community by virtue of having given a famous commencement speech at Wellesley as a political up-and-comer in the anti-war movement, in the counterculture, as it was of that day.
Though she had been a Goldwater Republican, and even in her first years in college, a campus Republican.
She had been a campus Republican in her first year at Wellesley, and then had started moving leftward, as many students did in the 60s. What's so interesting about Hillary in this period is while other students became radicalized, she did not. She kept one foot firmly in her innate personal conservative history from her family, and another embraced, I would say, liberal thought of the day, but always rejected radicalism, even though she was willing to brush up against it. She went to work for a radical law firm on the West Coast in her first year, after her first year of law school, represented the Black Panthers, members of the Communist Party. And interestingly enough, and typically enough, in her autobiography, she skips over the part about the fact that it was known as a leftist firm and just talks about her work handling a couple cases.
But still, one foot back in those more conservative values at the same time. And it's a fascinating juxtaposition. Just gets more fascinating when Bill Clinton comes on the scene. I want to ask Carl Bernstein about that connection with Bill Clinton, its origins, and how it developed. But let's listen just to a bit of tape here. 1992, anyone who was around remembers it. A woman named Jennifer Flowers came forward during Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, claimed she'd had an affair with Bill Clinton. January 26, 1992, Hillary and Bill Clinton appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes, Hillary fiercely defending her husband.
You know, I'm not sitting here as some little woman standing by my man like Tammy Wynette. I'm sitting here because I love him, and I respect him, and I honor what he's been through and what we've been through together.
Carl Bernstein, take us back to the origins of that relationship, what she first thought of him, he of her, and their friends of the pair.
There was an instant connection. Like many people, she recognized that Bill Clinton stood for really wonderful things politically, that he also was as great a political talent of his generation as we have seen. But she also recognized early in their relationship something others didn't, that his sexual compulsions would make him politically not viable if they persisted or if they weren't covered up. And so much of their marriage and their political partnership and their march to the White House was about covering up those sexual compulsions. I was thinking, listening to your question, about what it is that's so different about her story as I tell it. And it goes back to something that happens all the time with her, or much too frequently, not all the time. And that is she tells half the story. The same is true during the Jennifer Flowers episode that you've just talked about. By the time she made that statement, she was well aware of a whole body of research that the Clinton campaign had done on Jennifer Flowers. They had obtained statements from Jennifer Flowers saying that Jennifer Flowers had not had sexual relationships with her husband, and yet there were most people in the campaign believed otherwise, or many people in the campaign believed otherwise.
She was a wife at that point. I mean, what is her role and responsibility? To sit on 60 Minutes and say, yes, my husband has a sexual compulsion and he had an affair with this woman and let me count the ways?
No. I think that indeed what caused so much trouble politically is that once they got to the White House, there came to be all these investigations, and at bottom what was sealed in a box, as it were, figuratively speaking, and the box opened up with the suicide of Vince Foster. It was a Pandora's box
that could never be put back sealed again,
were her efforts partly to cover up all of these affairs by intimidating and savaging these women. And it's come back to haunt her.
You know, I want to put that in a context. People go quickly to the sexual thing, and the whole country went to it with Monica Lewinsky.
The important thing is not the fact that Bill Clinton had, in fact, in the book itself, there's not a single mention of a sex act, just a mention of a couple women, but particularly one, Marilyn Jo Jenkins, who Bill Clinton fell in love with and you know, it's revealed in the book for the first time, he wanted to leave the marriage.
In the late 80s, nearly brought the marriage to an end.
He was, again, it's back to half the story that Hillary tells. He wanted to leave the marriage, be with Marilyn Jo Jenkins, and he also was in the midst of what Betsy Wright, who was his chief of staff and who I talked to at great length, called a breakdown. He was reckless as governor. He wasn't performing in his job well. He was obsessed with this woman. And then, according to Betsy Wright, Hillary wouldn't let him out of the marriage, didn't want to give him a pass, as Betsy Wright said. Eventually, Bill Clinton decided he wanted to stay in the marriage, save the marriage, and they worked on it.
Here's what I want to ask you about, though, Carl. There's a context for that that's fascinating, as you describe it, a very political context for this most intimate relationship. And you describe it as the journey. These two people, smart, bright, ambitious, and very aware that they were on a journey with particular political goals. What's the journey?
Well, first of all, the journey is a love affair. Never, ever make the mistake of thinking that these aren't two people who were deeply in love and continue to be in love.
You can see it in the old photographs, no question about it.
And you can see it in the present photographs. Mm-hmm. But the journey, which is their term, was that they had political ideals that stemmed from each of their respective beliefs that became melded and complemented by their particular areas of expertise. And obviously, Bill Clinton, from the time that he met Hillary, said he was going back to Arkansas to run for office, and that he saw high office as attainable, and Hillary was going to help him get there.
What was the great goal? I mean, with all the triangulation and maneuvering that comes along with office, it can get lost. But you say that the journey, there's the romantic side, but on the political side, you say they would change the American story. In what direction? How did they understand what they were setting out to do on the journey?
Well, first of all, Bill Clinton is the amazing political talent of our era. And he understood things about the Democratic Party, for one, and its need to move toward the center to be electable that others did not. He clearly was headed for the presidency if he could succeed in his home state. People had been saying it about him since he was in high school. Hillary had been saying it. The notion that Hillary was also headed for elective office is wrong, I believe, and I think I demonstrate in the book that she had rejected running for office, that she preferred to be a child advocate. She didn't like campaigning, and she had given up that notion to further Bill's career and yet to pursue her own interests in child advocacy. But the idea was that her ideas infused his, that they had common notions of what policy ought to be in this country, of what a political philosophy ought to be, which we saw in his presidential campaign called Putting People First, a menu of social programs and tax breaks for middle-class people. And meanwhile, Bill Clinton had studied the economy. Unlike many of his colleagues in the Democratic Party, and knew that it needed to be freer of government intervention. So they had a politics that was different than most people of their generation and also made him viable politically. But what made him unviable politically was his sexual compulsions.
And you describe so much of what went on in that White House as kind of a yo-yo in response to those. He'd then sort of bow to Hillary, and off we'd go. Carl Bernstein, we have a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. Let me begin to bring them in with you. Rosa Lee is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Rosa Lee. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I want to say, first of all, that I'm very disappointed with the news people because I feel as though they shape public opinion by their own opinion forward. They come up with a view. For instance, Hillary Clinton, she She's cold. She's unfeeling. She's not friendly. Blah, blah, blah. I feel that I have seen Hillary Clinton on CNN and various other programs, and I feel that Hillary is very warm, very friendly, and the news people, they seem like they're in lockstep. They come up with a view, what they did to Howard Dean, for instance. Oh, he can't control himself. He screamed. So that killed his campaign. Then when they were sick of the Clintons and they really wanted Bush, so anyway, no matter how well Al Gore did in those, in those debates, Bush won.
So you mean, say it's the media hanging a label on Carl Bernstein. What do you say to Rosalie?
I think I half agree with Rosalie that there's much too much of what she's talking about, and it's one of the reasons that I've written a biography that is intended to be nuanced and show a real picture of this woman rather than some caricature. There is a real danger in daily reporting, especially, of caricature, that really what good reporting is and what real biography is the best obtainable version of the truth. You're not going to get that from Hillary Clinton. You're not going to get that from too many reporters out there, I'm afraid to say. It's one of the reasons there is such dissatisfaction with the press in this country. I've written about it extensively myself. I'm not happy with the way the press often covers things. But I also think that we shouldn't make a kind of monolith out of the press, that there is some terrific reporting out there, and I'm sure Rosalie has read some of it.
Let's get to the heart of the complaint then, Carl. This latest Gallup poll last week, 50% said that their opinion of Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton, is unfavorable. Now, that's a very high unfavorable
rating. Well, I
wouldn't put
that on the press. I would put that on Hillary Clinton. I mean, people have a real chance to see Hillary Clinton. She's out there
every day.
It's
higher than John Kerry, higher than Al Gore. Why do you think that unfavorable?
Well, wait, let's go back to what Rosalie said.
Yeah.
Because Rosalie's got a very interesting thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
She finds her very warm. She finds her, and there is that side to Hillary Clinton, very much so, as well as another side. But my point is that if Rosalie can see that, so could other people. So to hang all this on the press is a little seems to me to be partly going up the wrong tree. We're talking about someone who constantly is exposing herself to the public. I think one of the things that is coming through that is contributing to that unfavorable view of many people is what I have called an inauthenticity. What I mean by that is she often says things that are at odds with what previously she has really said she believes. So there's a disconnect between words and actions because she's a candidate for office. Now, politicians do this all the time, but I think it serves her particularly badly because she aspires to be and is somewhat judged by different standards to be better than a conventional politician. And if she's going to make it to the presidency, it's going to be on that ground that she's laid out for herself. I am better than a conventional politician. Well, if you're going to be better, it means you can't do the same things that the conventional ones do and get away with it.
Let's go to New Haven, Connecticut, and Robert. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for putting me on the air.
Yeah.
I'm one of those who believes that your guest's reporting in the 1970s probably helped to save the Republic. But I'm not sure that I feel as positive about the writing that he's doing now. Paul Krugman has what I consider a devastating column in today's New York Times, denouncing the focus on authenticity in our current political reporting.
Paul Krugman, you say, yes.
Yeah, I read that column, and in fact, when I'm talking about authenticity, I'm talking about something different than Paul was writing about. What I'm talking about is a disconnect between words and actions. I'm not talking about hair color or headbands or anything of the kind. And also, in terms of this business of what I'm writing today, it's very interesting. I urge you to go on. That what I hear a lot of is because I've written a book that might portray Hillary Clinton in a truthful, contextual, nuanced way, some people, particularly those who tend to support Hillary Clinton or believe in the same things she does, and incidentally, I believe in many of the same things, think that I'm doing a great disservice by reporting what's truthful. when in fact, if you go look, for instance, on VanityFair.com and look at the pieces that I've written about George Bush, saying that his presidency has been the most disastrous and catastrophic in our history, that he is the most mendacious of presidents, more so than Richard Nixon. The same people who come after me on Hillary very often say, oh, well, Bernstein's been really terrific on the subject of George Bush. Don't try to put my reporting in an ideological box.
Got it. Let me get another call, Carl. We hear that. Joby's calling from San Francisco. Joby, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
The issue that I have with Hillary isn't Mr. Bernstein's reporting. It's been her recent move towards triangulation style of politics. I remember when she was campaigning with Bill in the early 90s, I thought I could vote for her because she stood for something. You know, the health care issue was a big thing. She stood by it, and there was no pandering to either side. You know, like one of the things she's done most recently that just sends me and should every progressive or liberal up the wall is this pandering to the conservative base by proposing support for a flag-burning amendment. I mean, that's just that's triangulation politics at its worst, waiting to see how everybody would vote for this recent funding bill before coming out against it. That's not leadership. That's just this annoying triangulation.
Joby, our time is short before the break. Let us pick it up, Carl.
I think that he's raised, though, a terrific point. It's not a question, but in the last chapter of the book, I address exactly that. The question of flag burning is being symptomatic of what she has done. Here's a constitutional law student, a lawyer, who wouldn't be caught dead, according to those who know her best, endorsing a constitutional amendment for flag burning 10, 15 years ago. And now here she is saying she believes in it. That, to me, is what I mean by inauthenticity. I think it is a big problem, as well as the fact that since she is in the Senate, she has ducked many of the great national issues of the day, whether you use the phrase triangulation or just plain duck, she has not been in the leadership in the Congress, in the Senate of the United States, with the exception of a woman's right to choose on the great national issues.
We're talking this hour with Carl Bernstein. His big new biography of Senator Hillary Clinton is A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Let's go to tape and just keep her voice in this conversation as well. January this year, at a campaign stop in Davenport, Iowa, Hillary Clinton was asked at a town hall meeting if she could stand up to evil men around the world. Hillary showed a bit of humor.
We face a lot of evil men, you know, people like Osama bin Laden comes to mind. And what in my background equips me to deal with evil and bad men?
A lot of laughter. She clarified later that she was just trying to add a bit of levity.
You guys keep telling me, lighten up, be funny. You know, I get a little funny, and now I'm being psychoanalyzed.
And there we go. Let's go to Fred calling from Derry, New Hampshire. Fred, you're on the air with Carl Bernstein.
Thank you. A comment and a quick question.
Yeah.
Comment being, I'm a liberal who works with some good conservatives, right-wing religious types, and I get sort of secondhand some views of that camp. Rush Limbaugh in the background, and such joy as that. What I'm aware of is that the Hillary factor with this crowd, to use a loose term, really seems to be a hot button. With a lot of hot buttons, it's about emotion, not thought. If it's gay marriage, if it's the quota, that stuff isn't happening so much now. So it seems like Hillary would give the Republicans a great hot button rallying thing to incense and unify them. Unfortunately. The other quick question is, I do a lot of reading, and I've enjoyed your guest's work, and I just wanted to ask him, is there a difference now than there was in 74 when things like the Pentagon Papers or his work, just information coming out, would make a difference with the politic in general or the public?
Fred, let's take it straight to Carl. Carl Bernstein, you hear both threads.
Let's take the second part first. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is a difference. We have a vastly superheated media environment today because of the web, because of the profusion of so much information coming at us, the 24-hour news cycle of the web. It's very hard, I think, for readers, viewers, listeners, and eyeballs, as they were, to sort through the noise and stuff that's being thrown at them, whereas at the time of Watergate, we had certain so-called mainstream media institutions that had well-known standards. And if in a major institution like the Washington Post you had a story like Watergate, eventually, and even there people were skeptical about what we were writing, eventually it took hold and the system itself worked. Today, there's much more skepticism about because things are put in terms of a cultural war that's going on and has been going on since the post-Watergate era. The Clintons are very much a part and a focal point of that cultural war. So it's a totally different environment. And yet some of our newspapers, the Modern Washington Post, the Modern New York Times, the Modern Wall Street Journal, are better papers, not necessarily in all their reporting, but are better papers, great daily news magazines than they were at the time of Watergate. So the point you're asking about or suggesting about Hillary being an easy target for the Republicans, I think we need to wait and see about that. That, among other things, what's so noticeable about the difference between her and the Rush Limbaughs that you describe is what they believe in terms of policy. And the attack on Hillary Clinton often comes less on the reality of what her policies are than in a right-wing interpretation of some kind of socialism, which God knows she's not a socialist, mocking her religion. Well, one of the things that I have found is that she is deeply religious since childhood. Religion and a melding of the values of her Methodism and John Wesley's admonition of service.
Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, as ever you can.
Right. And it, some people have interpreted this as an aspect of her character that makes her self-righteous. Others have interpreted it as the motivating and best factor of her politics. But whatever the case, it's real. It's not a fake. And when she was up there the other day on the conversation about faith with two of the other candidates, what she was saying about not wearing it on her sleeve is very true. So I think those things worked to her advantage.
What about her relationship with the conservative Republican base when she's not quite as tied to Bill? He's still around, heaven knows. But when you look back on the 90s and you look at Hillary Clinton now, do you think she's the same kind of hot button? Does it have the same – she have the same heat volatility?
Well, I think she is trying to cool down the button. The question is, in cooling down the button, is she pouring water on her essential self? And the fact that she has stood strongly for things in the past and now is appearing wishy-washy with all that water coming down. And I think there is that's partly why I've written what I've written in this book, is to show that there is a whole story that holds together. One of the things that interests me the most is the whole question of Vince Foster in the Clinton presidency, because it was only the 6th month of the Clinton presidency when Vince Foster committed suicide. Right. And that is like a dividing line at that front end of the Clinton presidency, after which everything changed.
Why? What should we understand about that from your research?
Well, first of all, you have to understand how close the relationship was between Vince Foster and Hillary Clinton.
They had been partners at the Rose Law Firm.
Well, there was also an intimacy as Webb Hubble, her other law partner, an assistant attorney general who went to jail in the Clinton presidency, told me they were closer than lovers.
That's a loaded word and phrase. And what does it mean exactly?
Well, I think what it means is that they shared confidences that they wouldn't share with other people, that they loved each other's company, and they had none of the messiness of a love affair. But they went to each other. They recognized each other's vulnerabilities. I think if there was such thing as a male confidant in her life, it was Vince Foster.
Did he kill himself to save her then, to shield her?
If I could finish, please.
Sure.
And when Vince Foster committed suicide, he knew more about the Clintons about their personal lives mm-hmm. and about the policies and undertakings of the Clinton White House than any individual in the White House, with the exception of Bill and Hillary, because of that personal relationship. Mm-hmm. And there began a series of investigations because of his suicide, ironically, that became the most possibly damaging thing that could happen to Bill and Hillary Clinton, because it took a searchlight and trained it on their past in Arkansas, their finances, their personal lives, their relationship, the other women, her savaging of women. And part of the story, the great untold saga of the Clinton presidency and the Clinton marriage, is this ironic, horrible fallout from his suicide. And I tell that story, and it's a subtext almost in the narrative of this book, because you can't understand what happened in the Clinton years in the White House without understanding, and in the Arkansas years too, for that matter, without understanding this relationship between Hillary and Vince Foster, and how his death caused a cataclysm for the Clintons.
Explain. To the extent you found it, you described the Clintons as a very, very real partnership. Bill Clinton described themselves as a team, a two-for-one, as he came into the White House. We've seen that with Bill in the senior position, with Bill as the elected president. If it were to come to pass that it were the other way around, or already with Hillary's sort of coming into her own as a senator, does it bring a different Hillary to the fore? And what's the difference?
Well, first of all, for some 20 years, Hillary Clinton was the constant in Bill's process. She helped manage him. She knew his weaknesses. She knew his faults. He was notoriously slow to make decisions. She could hurry him up. And one thing she's always saying is, hurry up, Bill. He takes great time in making decisions. But she was his manager, as it were.
But if she's freed of that role.
Again, if I could just finish.
Well, yeah.
Dick Morris said of her, as their political aide, that she was an insulin that helped him process everything. And now he has become her insulin, as it were, in the background, helping her process everything. I think that answers your question.
Well, almost, but not quite. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, does a different, when she's not having to manage him, does her character likely emerge in a different way? Have you seen it already, comparing her now with her frame of mind and her interactions with people in the 90s when she was at the height of that helping manage Bill? You know, what aspect of her personality do you see coming forward that was not able to when she was helping manage him?
I think and demonstrate that she has felt liberated since she has been in the Senate, that she has been the dominant, as it were, figure in the partnership in a way that she was only occasionally in other years. And those occasional times occurred mainly when she was saving him in politically, such as in the Jennifer Flowers episode that you played earlier on the air here, and during the Lewinsky ugliness, in which she came forward to again offer connubial credence to their partnership and to say that she believed in her husband. She's now the dominant figure in the foreground. He's in the background now, and I think that's changed everything, and I think that it has allowed her to become more of herself, and yet, as he becomes her advisor politically, she goes, as your listeners have suggested, more and more toward this triangulation, to use the word that they're using today, that is a kind of airbrush. And airbrushing is something that has always been part of Hillary Clinton's modus operandi.
Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Ned. Hi, Ned. You're on the air with Carl Bernstein.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess my question for Carl, is whether his criticisms of Hillary aren't really applicable to all candidates at that level. This, you know, some level of inauthenticity, shifting positions on hot buttons.
As I said earlier in the broadcast, that indeed, and I hope I'm doing more than criticize Hillary Clinton, because what I'm trying to do here is say that we now have the ability to have a full picture of Hillary Clinton. We know enough through the kind of reporting that I do to talk to those who have never talked on the record before. Webb Hubble, Betsy Ebeling, her closest childhood friend, Diane Blair, the closest friend of her life, and put together a nuanced picture of her, which she has prevented from being out there in the past. So now we have it. But your particular questions about the things that you hear as critical, don't other politicians do it? Absolutely they do. But what I've said is that she has always aspired to be judged as someone who is not a conventional politician. And if she is going to make it to the White House, I suspect it will be because she is able to convince people she's not a conventional politician. And when I talk about that so-called inauthenticity, it is when she reverts to being a conventional politician who is willing to say almost anything to get elected or embrace something like flag burning that's totally at odds with her history and her nature.
Ned, thanks for calling. Let's go to Daniel in Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Mr. Bernstein has a lot of fascinating things. I'm really interested in the show. But one qualm is calling Hillary and Bill's lifetime of political idealism. I think there are some really solid reasons why people think of her as ruled only by ambition. And I kind of think of both the Clintons as an empty shell, because I think that Bill going to the right, becoming a centrist, he never realized how much the Republicans were going to hate him for being such a political, savvy, persuasive centrist, do anything to stop him. And the basic thing that Republican mendacity did was to bring the entire country to the right. And I think him going along with George Bush Sr. around the world proves that he just wants to be loved by everyone.
And Hillary, we're talking Hillary, Daniel. What do you say about Hillary?
Hillary is very similar. There's the ambition. There's the need to be admired. But she doesn't have the basic skills to be lovable.
And Daniel, our time's short. I'm sorry to interrupt, but Carl Bernstein.
I disagree with the premise of the question, because Bill Clinton, among other things, that what moved the country, pardon me, to the right during the Clinton presidency was the election of the Gingrich Congress in 1994. And that was largely a result of Hillary's botched handling of health care, the ethical pall that hung over the presidency because of her actions in the so-called travel office fiasco, Whitewater. Not that there was anything awful about Whitewater, except that she didn't want people to know what had happened, and it achieved proportions that became ruinous rather than just letting the facts out there and take her lumps. And this is what brings us to the present. I believe if Hillary Clinton were to let the facts out there and not fight constantly every time there is a story, or in the instance of my book, a major attempt at a contextual narrative of her life, and just let it be out there and not fear it and not go on the attack mode and back to her warrior woman mentality, I think she'd be much better served. And I think a lot of what your callers today are saying is that there seems to be this disconnect between this thoughtful person, and it also does get to a question of capability. One of the big questions that occurred in the Clinton presidency was of competence. Donna Shalala, her great friend, who was Secretary of Health and Human Services, talks to me about how she found Hillary's competence to be not nearly what it was cracked up to be, and especially you see that in healthcare. So these are the kind of questions that ought to be raised.
Well, live and learn, maybe the word there, and how much voters think she has learned. Certainly lived a lot, and you've covered a lot of it in the book. A Woman in Charge is the big new bio by Carl Bernstein. Mr. Bernstein, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.